This is Janine Roebuck singing Introtina from Orv's Carmina Burana. This, however, is not how Janine herself hears it. With the volume set to very high, this is what she hears. I'm in Janine's living room in her house in South London. Janine, I'm here to talk to you about your deafness, how it affects you and how it has influenced your career. So, when did you realise you were losing your hearing?
From the age of about 18, I was aware that I had inherited the family gene, the deafness gene, from my father's side of the family, which goes back many generations, which is neurosensory loss, which is progressive. I was singing Pamina in the Magic Flute at university, and I thought, it's a bit tricky. So the director of the opera was also involved in the audiology department, so he tested me and my father, because he was very interested in the hereditary aspect of things, and he actually said to me, he met me on campus and said, we've got the results now, and obviously just enjoy your singing while you can, because with that sort of hearing loss, there's absolutely no way you'll ever be able to have a career in music. And I sort of smiled sweetly and said, thank you very much, and then went home and broke my heart, you know. So that's when I decided I'd do it anyway. A little bit of a rebel.
Well, sometimes you need something like that.
Yeah, you do.
When you did start losing your hearing, did you feel isolated?
Being deaf is the most isolating thing in the world. It's a terrible, terrible thing, and it makes you, if you're not careful, you really start to go into yourself and become introspective, and you don't want to go to social engagement, don't want to go out for supper, don't want to meet with friends, don't want to go to parties.
Janine is one of 9 million people in the UK who have significant problems with their hearing. Deafness has many causes, but one of the major ones is ageing. Despite the fact that in our ageing society we are ever more likely to become deaf, many of us don't know very much about it. What does the world sound like to deaf people? How do the ears and the brain work together to make sense of sounds? And how far have scientists come in restoring impaired hearing? In this documentary, I will explore some of these questions and create a soundscape that can give those of us with normal hearing a sense of what it must be like to be deaf. At the University of Cambridge, I spoke with Brian Moore, an expert in how our hearing works, right down to the minute physiology of the inner ear.
There's a membrane that runs along the length of the cochlea called the basilar membrane.
The cochlea is part of the ear that you cannot see, the inner ear. It is shaped like a spiral and made out of hollow bone with fluid inside. The fluid moves as a result of vibrations created by sounds that enter our ears. The basilar membrane that Brian is talking about is located right inside this fluid.
And when a sound enters the ear, it sets up vibrations on this membrane. And the membrane has physical properties that vary along its length. At one end, it's wide and it's kind of floppy, so it bends easily. And at the other end, it's rather narrow and it's quite stiff. It resists being bent. And because of that variation in physical properties, it turns out that the basilar membrane is tuned. Each place responds best to one frequency. So the end that is narrow and stiff responds best to high frequencies, and the end that's wide and floppy responds best to low frequencies.
So it is a bit like a rubber band. If you stretch a rubber band as far as you can, it becomes quite stiff, and when you ping it, the resulting sound is high-pitched. But when the rubber band isn't stretched very far, and it is still quite floppy, the resulting sound has a much lower pitch. To find out what the range of frequencies is that I'm still able to hear, Helen Nuttall of the MRC Institute for Hearing Research in Nottingham gave me a hearing test and created an audiogram of my hearing.
So this is your audiogram, and basically I play little beeps to your ears separately. And what you can see along the horizontal axis are different frequencies. So we've got low frequencies beginning on the left and then higher frequencies on the right. So we start off at kind of a normal, kind of comfortable level, and it gradually gets quieter to find the point at which you can no longer hear that frequency. So for you, you're doing really well at 2 kilohertz and 4 kilohertz in your right ear particularly, which are good frequencies to be doing well on because they're important for speech. You've got a slight dip at 8 kilohertz, but that's very normal. The high frequency hearing starts to go. That's the first thing that starts kind of going for all of us as we age. So even very young people are already kind of going down in the 8 kilohertz range.
Somebody with a hearing loss will have much more difficulty detecting the beeps, and the volume needs to be set much higher for them to be able to hear them at all. Where I could still hear beeps that were close to 0 decibels, a deaf person may need volume levels of 80 dB or more to detect the beeps. That's comparable to hearing the sound of a stationary motorbike from across the road directly into your ear. But why do people go deaf? Jan Schnoop is a neuroscientist at the University of Oxford, and he has been spending the last 20 years or so working on understanding how the brain makes sense of sounds. He explains what causes loss of hearing.
You know, your brain can basically sense how much vibration you have in the high frequency and the low frequency parts respectively, because there are little hair cells that live on that basilar membrane. Now, those tiny hair cells that you get on the basilar membrane, sadly, are very, very sensitive. They have to be, because there's only very little energy in the vibrations and sound waves. So they have to be very sensitive for us to be able to hear anything at all, but it's very easy to break them. Excessively loud sounds, various chemicals in the environment and so on, can all cause them to die. And some people are unfortunate and have a genetic predisposition that these hair cells will die off in them sooner than later. But all of us will have some hair cell loss as we age. And when they die, they don't grow back. And that is the most common cause of hearing loss.
When hair cells are lost, it becomes much harder to distinguish two tones with a different pitch from one another. This really affects the understanding of speech for a deaf person, especially when there is noise in the background, from a car engine, music, or other people chatting. Despite the cafe noise, you will have no trouble following what I'm saying. But to someone with Janine's hearing loss and without hearing aids, speech in a busy cafe sounds much like this. But hearing loss does not affect all frequencies in equal proportions. Jan explains how that affects Janine's hearing.
So, for reasons that we don't really understand, the high frequency parts of the basilar membrane seem to be more sensitive than the low frequency parts. So if you've got outer hair cell loss, the high frequency hearing goes sooner than the low frequency hearing. And of course, Janine seems to have this high frequency loss in a particularly pronounced fashion. So that means that, you know, in her case, it's really all the brightness of the sound that goes first. And increasingly, you know, as this sort of, with this progressive hearing loss, as it encroaches more and more on the frequencies that we use for speech, speech will become harder and harder for her to hear.
I'm Harry Thomas. I'm 18 years old. I've got a cochlear implant on my right side and an ordinary hearing aid on my left-hand side.
At his home in Leicester, Harry tells me about his profound deafness, which he's had since he was born. We also talk about growing up surrounded by people with normal hearing and about how he benefits from his cochlear implant. We'll talk about those in a couple of minutes, but first a little bit more about the difficulty understanding speech in noisy situations.
You know, when two people are talking at once, that's really difficult because I can't switch one off. In that situation, I'd turn my hearing aids off because then I could focus on just lip reading. Well, that's been another struggle, really, finding pubs. You know, if we go out to a pub or a restaurant with my family, we have to find a quiet corner or a quiet restaurant because I just become a recluse.
And Janine has a similar story.
Actually, I have to say this. Being deaf is exhausting. It is so tiring. You have no idea. It's like learning a foreign language. You know, when you're in a foreign country and you're really concentrating to listen and to try and understand what they're saying to you. And even when I was in France, you know, by the end of the day, I would say, oh, I'm sorry, I can't hear anymore. I'm too tired. And it's the same with deafness. You know, it's like, oh, I can't do it anymore now. I'm too tired.
Scientists have recently started looking at the effort someone needs to put in to understand speech in quiet and noisy situations. And they suggest that processes independent from the ear very much influence our ability to hear. How well you're able to focus your attention on one thing in the presence of many others does not really depend on your ears, but ultimately depends on your brain.
What actually happens in the ear itself is relatively straightforward.
Andrew King is professor of neurophysiology at the University of Oxford. His research focuses on how our brain helps us to understand speech, music, and any other sounds.
But it's the processing that happens after that, that happens within the brain itself, that gives rise to our ability to distinguish sounds based on their spectral content, on their frequency content, our perception of pitch, how we can distinguish a male voice from a female voice, or two different musical instruments that play the same note. And it's the neural processing that goes on within the brain that allows us to appreciate those differences.
So after the hair cells have picked up the sound, the brain allows you to recognize this. As the keyboard, and this. As a recorder, even as they are playing the same notes. But being aware of the difference between two musical instruments, or even understanding speech, are not necessarily the most important roles of our hearing. Our hearing provides us with information our eyes can't give us. We can hear things coming towards us from behind, and a loud noise will immediately make us turn our head towards its source. But for hearing impaired people, even those with milder hearing loss than Harry or Janine, this information is much less accurate.
Because I haven't got a sense of direction or hearing, anything that's behind me, or to the side of me, or in front of me, it's all there in one go. It's not behind me, it's not to the side of me, it's not in front of me, it's in my head. You know, obviously some sounds will be quieter than the others, and some will be louder than the others, but it's when they all come together, but it's just, as I say, it's a barrage. You know, I cannot hear anything at all.
Localising where a sound is in space, how you can tell the direction of an oncoming motor car, for example, when you're crossing the road, relies principally on the fact that we have two ears and we can compare the sounds, very small difference in the sounds that reach the two ears, and the brain is able to compute those differences and infer from that where the sound originated with respect to us.
To help hearing impaired people localise where sounds are coming from, Brian Moore at Cambridge has spent years creating directional hearing aids.
You have two hearing aids, one on each ear, and these hearing aids actually can swap signals. They have wireless transmission from one hearing aid to another, and you can control it using a remote control, so that if you're at a dinner, let's say, and you want for the moment to talk to the person on the left, then you can set your hearing aids to focus to the left and they'll selectively pick up those sounds and not pick up the sounds from the right or the front or the back.
The next goal of researchers and manufacturers is to create smart hearing aids that don't need a remote control but can use brain signals to tell them where to focus. Everybody will know of hearing aids and how they boost the sound for their user, but scientists are now able to bypass the entire ear and send sound information directly into the nerve cells without needing the hair cells. These are cochlear implants. Here's Jan again to explain how they work.
Unlike hearing aids, cochlear implants won't try to amplify the vibrations because there's no longer any sensitivity to vibrations in the ear. Instead, you have to try and stimulate the nerves of the auditory, the nerve fibers of the auditory nerve directly, electrically. So in a cochlear implant, what ENT surgeons do is that they insert a very fine electrode array into the coil of the cochlea. It's really just like a bundle of fine wires that you shove into the cochlea, and they will run along the cochlea, and they will then, these wires will then produce little electrical pulses that directly electrically stimulate nerves of the nerve fibers of the eighth nerve.
When I had my cochlear implant, that was a big change in my life. That was a dramatic change, very dramatic change, and I heard a lot more things. I don't actually remember what my hearing was like before the cochlear implant. I don't remember exactly what I heard. But all I do know is that it was such a big change that I got excited that I could hear the washing machine in my room from downstairs. You know, the washing machine was in the kitchen, and I was upstairs in my room. I got worried because I thought there was a truck coming through the house or something. You know, I ran downstairs and it's just a washing machine. Hearing my mum with a hairdryer in the other room, I started hearing things that I didn't even know exist.
In Nottingham, Bernard Sieber works on improving cochlear implants. He tells me about their limitations.
My name is Bernard Sieber. I'm heading a research group on spatial hearing and auditory perception in general at the MRC Institute of Hearing Research in Nottingham. Cochlear implants seem to be very successful for the general transmission of speech. So speech understanding with implants has improved over the last years quite drastically.
To a cochlear implant user, speech in a quiet environment is relatively easy to understand. What they hear sounds similar to this.
Hearing loss? Yes, loss is what we hear who are starting to go deaf. Loss
trails a lot of weird puns in its wake. That's a real prism of the left. You'd like me to repeat that? The sad surrealism of the deaf.
But when instead of being in a quiet room, the cochlear implant user tries to follow what someone is saying in a busy cafe, what they hear sounds much more like this.
Hearing loss? Yes, loss is what we hear. You are starting to go deaf.
Loss trails a lot of weird puns.
Cochlear implants are very problematic still when there are background sounds, when there is noise around the listener. So when there is not only one speaker, but when there are multiple speakers, or when there is reverberation in the room, then those patients have severe difficulties following that one speaker. And something similar happens when they listen to music. Music is composed usually of multiple instruments, and it's very difficult to follow one of the instruments in the presence of all the others. Rhythms work quite well.
I've always loved listening to music. I don't think I could cope having two implants. And it's like when you've got a really bad car stereo and it's just so tinny, it's just like, oh, turn it off. You know, that's what it would be like for me. But, you know, if it's having the hearing, it's like having a full sound system. You know, real clarity. They complement each other really well.
Another issue with implants is that we have only very few electrodes, say 12 to 24 electrodes, depending on the implant. Whereas in normal hearing, we have several thousand hair cells and nerve fibers.
So going from several thousand spots on the cochlea that are able to receive frequency information to only about 12 to 24 such spots will have a huge effect on the frequencies that a cochlear implant user is still able to hear.
Generally, their perception of pitch height, so of the melodies that are associated with the music, that is also quite impaired. So there's lots to be done.
Quite how different music and sound to deaf people becomes clear from an experience Janine had several years ago.
I can remember when I was at university, the album Tubular Bells was very popular. I used to listen to this a huge amount. And it came out, you know, one of those sort of Daily Mail free CDs. And I thought, oh, how marvellous, I'll listen to this, you see. And I didn't recognise it at all. because I had been listening to it without hearing aids and with hearing loss, and I was hearing different frequencies and different instruments to the ones I'd heard before, and so I didn't recognise the piece at all.
It's a pity, in a way, that not much research has been done on the effects of hearing loss on music perception, even though that's an important part of many people's lives. We know that hearing loss does impair the enjoyment of music and the ability to deal with music.
The first thing I did was Countess Maritza, the part of the Gypsy Fortune Teller. It's got an elaborate flute cadenza that you know you have to sort of mirror, and you have to be very much together, and it was absolute torture for me, you know, and I thought, oh, I'm going to have to give up, I can't do this. And indeed, there have been times, I mean, I once had a crit that said, I began to wonder if she could hear the orchestra at all at one point. And I thought, well, you have no idea how true that was. Not entirely my fault, but the Fellback speakers weren't working. So everybody was having problems, but I was having more than most.
Despite the difficulty and stress, Janine loves singing for audiences across the globe. And when in 2007 she finally openly admitted to being deaf, her performance became freer and she now feels at height of her career.
I am Paul Whittaker, Artistic Director of Music and the Deaf, which is a charity I set up 23 years ago in 1988 to help deaf people and those who live and work with them get involved in music and the arts. We set up our first Deaf Youth Orchestra 5 years ago, I think it was. The players in the orchestra have a huge range of hearing losses. Some might just have a mild hearing loss. Some are profoundly deaf, some have cochlear implants, some don't wear hearing aids because they don't get any benefit from them.
As Paul and the growing number of members of the Deaf Youth Orchestra prove, Janine is not the only deaf person who enjoys making music.
Why should deaf people be interested in music at all?
Why shouldn't they? That's a very sort of cop-out, slightly rude answer. But just because somebody's ears don't work doesn't mean they can't enjoy music.
Paul has been profoundly deaf since birth. Despite his deafness, he grew up playing music, studying music, and working in music, and his contributions to music were awarded with an OBE in 2007. Perhaps as a result of his hearing loss, his body has become an important tool when he plays the organ.
I remember once I was playing the organ in Bradford Cathedral, that the layout of Bradford Cathedral, the position of the organ, and the acoustics of the building are quite bizarre. What I normally do is I play in a valley on what I feel. And because I was waiting for the sound to come out from the organ pipe, hit the wall and come back at me, I was playing really, really slowly. And I knew it was slow. And someone said, you've actually got to ignore what your body tells you and just play.
Generally though, Paul's acute sensitivity to vibrations on the skin help him tremendously when he's making music. And Harry has a similar experience.
Believe it or not, I go to quite a lot of clubbing, but in that situation, I turn my hearing aids off. Because obviously when I turn my hearing aids off, this is probably another interesting aspect, when I turn my hearing aids off, I become hypersensitive. And I can, you know, feel things around me really easily. You know, if you lose one sense, other senses compensate for it. So for me, hypersensitivity is one, and going into a club, I turn my hearing aids off because then I can feel the music.
This may not just be a subjective feeling, but may also have a physiological basis. Here's Andrew again to explain.
If someone is deaf, that means that the hearing parts of the brain, if they're completely deaf, will of course no longer be able to respond to sound. And what you find, at least at the level of the cerebral cortex, and also to some extent lower down, is that inputs from other sensory modalities start to take over. This has been most extensively studied with vision, but it's also true of tactile inputs as well. And for some of the very low frequencies of hearing, these correspond to the same sort of frequencies that you might encounter as stimuli touching the body surface. And so if someone who is deaf has a greater representation of their visual world, but also of their body surface within the brain, taking over some of the parts that are normally concerned with hearing, this might provide a way in which they can have a greater appreciation of low frequency tactile vibrations that actually engage the hearing parts of the brain.
However, for people like Janine, none of this can fully compensate for the anguish she feels at no longer being able to hear as she once did.
I, of course, have heard music with, I hesitate to use the word normal, because I don't think there's a great deal normal about me, but with good hearing, if you like. I have to say that if I were given the opportunity to have my hearing back, I would give absolutely anything in the world for that. Yeah. I would.
But as we've heard, science is fast advancing on many fronts, and as technology improves and our understanding of the brain becomes ever more sophisticated, many scientists are hopeful for the future, and as Andrew reminds us, we've already come a long way in 40 years.
In terms of whether hearing can be restored completely, well, we're actually doing a pretty good job of that already. Cochlear implants are the most successful neuroprosthetic device by a long way. When these were first introduced back in the 1970s, they were very crude devices. Those devices have come on a long way in the intervening years, and they're now really quite sophisticated to actually improve the so-called processing strategies, the way in which the signals are delivered to the electrodes that are arranged within the ear, will only improve if we know more about how the brain works normally, how nerve cells in different parts of the brain respond to sound, and how that gives rise to our ability to identify what and where sounds are. And it's that information that will feed into improving implants within the cochlea.
But of course, people with hearing aids and cochlear implants will always retain one advantage over people with normal hearing.
If I'm really not enjoying what someone said, I'll just do my fake stretch and lean back a bit and discreetly switch them off and then smile and nod.
Janine, Harry and Paul have each dealt with their deafness in their own way, and even with hearing loss have managed to live a life rich with music. All three have benefited from the continuing improvement in hearing aids and implants, driven on by innovative research from scientists like Brian, Jan, Andrew and Bernard. Each person with hearing loss has different hopes and demands for the future. As we continue to uncover intricate workings of the ear and brain, we will be able to tailor hearing devices to each individual's needs. And this may allow Janine's own ears to enjoy music again in rich detail.